Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Jean Bolton. Jean has a background in theoretical physics and is a strategy consultant and also a part-time academic at both Bath and Cranfield universities. She is passionate about the implications of complexity theory for management and policy development, as well as its connection to spiritual traditions. It is this relationship between complexity theory and spirituality that will be the topic of our conversation today. Hello, Jean. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hello. Hi.
I wonder if we could start with me asking you, what is complexity theory and why you think it is so important?
Great question. Well, in a nutshell, complexity theory is how physics explains evolution. It provides a view of the world as organic, holistic, evolving, mm-hmm. rather than a traditional scientific view of the world as a predictable machine. It's important because the contention is that we've based our understanding of the social and natural world on the wrong science.
Yeah.
So that is the science of a machine. So that's why I feel it's important. It developed really out of the work of Ilya Prigozhin, amongst other people, who in the 1920s tells the story that he read a book on evolution by Henri Bergson. And Henri Bergson poses a question in the book about why does physics suggest that the universe either operates like an unchanging machine or decays into featureless dust, when evolution shows that life evolves into increasing complex forms.
Mm-hmm.
So the Newton's physics is about a machine view of the world. Thermodynamics is about a view of the world continuously decaying,
uh-huh.
And neither have anything to do with evolution. And Prigozhin says that he was really triggered by this thought, which really drove his work, for which he got the Nobel Prize in the 1970s. So physics, traditional physics, in order to do the maths, is the physics of closed systems.
Yeah.
That is a system that doesn't interact with the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most situations of interest in our world, be it an organisation or an ecology, or even most physical systems, are open to the wider world. They can exchange energy and matter and information with the outside world. And when you look at the physics of open systems, the thermodynamics of open systems, Prigozhin was able to show that form can emerge in the way that evolutionary forms emerge. So it was really that one word, open, was what it got the Nobel Prize for, and it made all the difference.
Yeah.
So that's where complexity theory came from. And I'd just like to summarise what complexity theory is, make a number of points.
Yeah.
So complexity theory is first of all telling us that it matters to think about the world as interconnected, as mm-hmm. systemic. That we can't just deconstruct our problems into bits and understand how those bits fit together. It's to do with the synergistic, holistic interconnection of different aspects of the situation. So there's this theme of systemic. There's then a theme of complexity theory is a dynamic theory. It's a theory of change. So a lot of physics is a description of how things are. This is about how patterns emerge and how they can then be changed. So we've got this kind of dynamic view.
Yeah.
And when I talk about patterns emerging, I mean things like archetypes, culture, or ecological patterns, who eats whom in an ecology, what particular species sustain in relation to others.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be patterns of relationships. So complexity theory can give you an understanding of how those patterns emerge, but also how those patterns can then be destabilized and changed by the particularities of events, of particular variations of chance, of decisions, that kind of thing. So it's a middle way, to use that word. It's a middle view between what structure and form emerges and how that changes in relation to the particularity, the minute particulars, as Blake talked about it, and it's the interplay of those two. So that's the second point, this dynamic theme about complexity theory. The third point to make is that it tells us that change happens in fits and starts. Mm-hmm. It's not smooth. So there can be a sense of things drifting, nothing much changes, and then seemingly suddenly things can tip into radically new forms, or can tip catastrophically into collapse. So there's that sense of change not being smooth. And the idea that new things can emerge that couldn't have been predicted, that couldn't have been known about in advance.
Okay, now you suggest that complexity theory as a worldview has been around for a long time in various articulations. Could we have sort of a bit of a dash through history, and starting off maybe with Buddhism and Taoism?
Yes, it was very interesting. I remember the day when Peter Allen had gone to a meeting in London and came back very excited, clutching a copy of the Tao Te Ching, which he'd picked up in a second-hand bookshop outside Old Street Tube. And he was saying, look at this, Gene. And he was reading out bits of the introduction to the Tao Te Ching, this particular version of it. And it read like a complexity theory textbook. That a lot of the ideas in the Tao Te Ching about flow, about the door not always being open, it could have been read as if it were a complexity theory textbook. And that got me interested in going back to the times when I'd read the Tao Te Ching and to Buddhism, and really really thinking about the similarities with those kind of traditions. And indeed to the Upanishads and to some of the kind of pre-Socratic traditions, which emphasise flow and becoming rather than being. It's a theory of becoming. And it's got this sense that there is form. So if you think about Heraclitus talking about you never step in the same river twice, yeah. It both embraces the fact that there's a uniqueness about experience. The river's never quite the same. Yeah. On the other hand, there are swirls and whirls and structure in the river, including its banks, but also including the vortices in the river that are relatively stable. You know, yeah. So it has this tension between form and change. And the Dalai Lama, for example, explaining. I went to listen to him talking about the. One of the Buddhist texts, and he said, I'll quote this, "There is no self-defining discrete reality. Forms or feelings are devoid of inherent existence. It is only on the basis of aggregation of subtle elements that forms exist. Mm-hmm. Form can only be understood in relational terms to their constitutive elements." So that's what I'm saying. It's like it's the same. So when you go back to this notion of flow, this notion of form, but change, this notion of becoming, it's really very similar. And I found that incredibly interesting. It really got me going, that the idea that the pre-Socratics, in the way they approached an understanding and Taoists and Hindu, all those traditions, in very different ways, you know, they were coming up with the same conclusions. Now, the really interesting question isn't why? Why is that? Mm. And I think that brings us on to another theme, which is the fact that they were experiencing the world through experience.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a theory, it wasn't a belief, it was saying, what do we see around us in the world, and how can we understand how it works? And I think, you know, it's a sort of critical subjective process. It's critical. It's not just saying, oh well, you know, the world is chaotic and we don't know. It's really working with an embodied experience, a meditative sort of experience, and lo and behold, all these different traditions in all different parts of the world were coming up with something very similar about a world view, an ontological understanding of you know, the way the world works. And here we are, you know, with a postmodern scientific theory that comes out of very complicated computer programs that reaches the same conclusion. Now, I think that's really, really exciting. So that's where I got to with it.
So both in these Asian worldviews and the pre-Socratic, it was a practice in a sense. They had these ideas of eudaimonia and flourishing, etc. So it wasn't just some pie-in-the-sky theory.
No, it was, you're bringing in kind of values in that, but just at the level of how does the world work, they observed this notion of becoming, this notion of form, but, you know, uniqueness. So it is, it's where science and spirituality weren't different. They were both, in a sense, a practice, an empirical practice. You know, that kind of leads us on to modernism. But, in a way, both religion and science then became issues of either belief or theory.
Yeah.
That we then looked at things through either a belief lens or a theory lens, and they appeared to split. But before that, natural philosophy was about how do we understand the way the world works and how do we immerse ourselves in the world to understand the way it works. So they were together at that time. Science and spirituality weren't split, I think.
Sure. And then came Plato, introducing a much more ordered view of the world.
Well, the interesting thing about Plato is I think you can kind of argue that, you know, that modernism goes back to Plato. And it's very, very interesting. So Plato in the Timaeus talks about a creator. So he brings in the idea of a creator. He has these ideal forms that sit somewhere outside the universe, and he introduces purpose. So the creator creates the world, and then the purpose of the world is to become ordered like these perfect forms. So it introduces perfection, it introduces somewhere to go, it's a sort of teleology, it introduces a creator. And he wouldn't have it, you know, he was kind of saying, you know, you can't have form that emerges. It's a kind of, you know, divine thing. It's a place where we're moving to. So that's a very different kind of, he introduces theory and he introduces this kind of story, which you have to believe.
Yeah.
And following through then many centuries to Newton, when Newton, and of course, you know, Newton's only part of the story. Newton gets the credit for the story, but an awful lot went on before Newton. But it was fantastic what Newton did. He was able to come up with a theory of gravity and predict how the solar system, how planets go around each other. It was a theory of how billiard balls knock into each other. But that was all it was. It wasn't a theory of everything. It was a very particular theory of physics that applied to very specific conditions and situations. But people got very excited by it and wanted it to become a theory of everything. And there's a very interesting correspondence at the time between one of Newton's students called Clark and Leibniz, where Leibniz was saying, even at the time, to peel back a bit, if you want to do the maths of Newton's theories, you have to have a frame of reference. And so if you're looking at billiard balls on a billiard ball table, it's easy. So you have the billiard ball table is the frame of reference. You elect a time zero before you use the cue on a billiard ball, and you define what is left and what is right. But if you want to apply to the theory of the whole universe, then somehow you've got to have a frame of reference which is outside the universe. So Leibniz challenged Newton on this and said, you know, well, how do you account for time zero? And Newton said, well, God set it off. God decides. And then Leibniz said, well, what if God had done it half an hour before or half an hour earlier? We'd have had a different universe. And Newton replied, well, God decides. Right. And in the queries to the optics, and I never found this particular one, but a mathematical physicist, ex-professor, well, emeritus professor of mathematical physics told me that there's another bit where Leibniz or somebody said, why is the solar system flat? And Newton's answer was, God periodically pats it back into place. So what is really, really interesting about this is the most scientific of scientific theories, the thing that defines modernist science, is predicated on axioms that are to do with what God did.
Yep.
So it doesn't work as a theory of everything unless you have God doing things. And what Lee Smolin, I love Lee Smolin's take on this, what Lee Smolin points out is there's an awful lot in the universe, like the particularity of the shape of the solar system and the Milky Way and the different sorts of planets. None of it's kind of ordered at all. It's very structured. But and Newton's theories have nothing to say about that. Yeah. Newton's theory is very particular. It's a very particular description of certain machine-like properties of certain systems, which was a huge move forward. But why we should ever think it was a theory of everything, you know, I can't imagine. And what happened, as you probably know, or one story of what happened, was that Voltaire, and whose lover was the Marquis, I like this bit, with the Marquis de Châtelet. And the Marquis de Châtelet was obviously a woman and was the mathematician who translated the Principia from Latin into French. And they used it as a kind of premise for the French Enlightenment, which was to do with design and, you know, designing a perfect social world. But this step, you know, that was taking this very particular piece of physics that was very particular in what it applied to. First of all, saying it acts as a theory of everything for the universe, apart from the fact it doesn't explain many qualities of the universe, and then saying, ergo, it applies to social systems, was a great step backwards for us in our modernist view. And the kind of paradox as well is that we have this kind of very mechanical theory that's become defined as what science is. But then we have an equally and a split off modernist religious view, which is all to do with believing certain things. And then we split the two and say this is objective and this is subjective, this can be measured and this is not. And somehow feel that applies to social systems. So it's really interesting how the split of the particular sort of modernist science then splits off a modernist religion, whereas in the past the two were together. And I'm not denigrating physics. That's what I did my training in. But physics has very particular takes on very particular things, and the bits don't join up.
Yeah.
And it's certainly, apart from when we get into complexity theory, it struggles with open emergent systems. Physics is generally about quite particular laws. So the laws of quantum physics apply to certain conditions, and classical physics applies to something else, relativity applies to something else. And as we know, we don't know how the bits join up. It's much more partial physics than people like to feel it is. It's they're partial lenses. Sorry, that was a long rant.
No. So would you say then, talking about Newton's theory, that although in many ways it made a lot of sense, his underlying assumption, and maybe Plato's as well, is one of metaphysics, if we understand metaphysics as believing something that is beyond experience?
Well, I don't know whether to blame Newton. I think, you know, Newton was just trying to work out how the planets went round each other, and was equally and more secretly passionately interested in alchemy. And you know, he came up with a bit of physics that worked very well. But I think the modernist view splits the objective from the subjective, whereas I think there's a way in which the truth about social systems is much is subjective. So it may not be metaphysical, but much is subjective. So it brings us on to evolution in a way. Shall I move on to...
To Darwin.
So Darwin, you know, so Newton was a very, very important figure in all this. But Darwin was hugely, hugely influential. What's so interesting about Darwin is, first of all, we're back to empiricism. So Darwin worked for many, very many years, both in terms of thinking and musing about what he was finding in the Galapagos Islands and other places, but also in doing experiments in animal husbandry and things. And he developed this tentative theory of evolution about variation being followed by selection. And what, as an aside, what complexity theory added to that was it was variation followed by ecologies in a variety of ways that were selected for. So it's where Darwin and the Descent of Man gets closer to talking about the kind of the systemic aspects of evolution. But it's a first in the history of philosophy, really, that it says variation is key, that you can't have change without messiness. So the pre-Socratics kind of knew that things were not perfect, but didn't really make it so clear that you can't have change without messiness and variation. So it was huge. It's about indeterminism, and it just revolutionised philosophy. People picked up William James. Picks up this whole idea of indeterminism. It affected evolutionary economics, Thorsten Babelen writes beautifully about, surely this is only rational. How could we ever think that we could base economics on theories of equilibrium and thermodynamics and take those physics theories? The only rational thing would be to see economics as an evolutionary science. And it's a different sort of science, because although the evolutionary principle might be universal, it really is saying you don't know what's going to happen. You only know what's evolved retrospectively. You don't know whether this is an evolutionary process or whether it's going to die down. So it brings science back in. It's an example of an empirical science which has principles that are universal, but is not predictable, is not repeatable, is not universal in the sense of you might get this evolution happening here, but it doesn't necessarily mean to say it's going to happen over there. So hugely influential and very exciting in effect. It came before, you know, there was a whole kind of revolution in physics, you know, as well, which led into more this idea of we don't know everything.
Yeah. So you mentioned Lee Smolin earlier. His theory ties in very much with this idea that even the laws, that we say the laws of nature, could have evolved rather than being constants.
Yes, I think it's really interesting. And when we come to talk a bit about the sort of what complexity says about spirituality, I think it's really interesting. So if I have great interest in this, if the evolutionary principle is the core principle, then how many big bangs were there? You know, how many times did the universe try to form and not get it right? Because when you look at it, what's so weird is we have a strong and a weak nuclear force and a gravity and a electromagnetic force. Why do we have four like that? If the gravitational constant was a minutely different, it wouldn't work. You know, if there wasn't a weak and a strong nuclear force, it wouldn't work. Yeah. So why has all that come together? Well, we don't know how many times it tried in some sense, you know, whatever that means. So it maybe everything evolves. And I think that has a link, which I'll talk about a bit later, to how we understand spirituality and so on too. So I think that's hugely interesting when I saw that, you know, that's the core, possibly the core process.
Yeah, so, okay, well, should we talk about that? What does the term spirituality mean to you, Jean?
Well, I think, and I'd like to talk about it a little bit in relation to how we define science as well. But
okay,
let me answer the nature of spirituality. So I think for me, and this is a kind of personal view, I think partly it has to do with questions of meaning and purpose. So I think that it has a quality about it. It's if I'm engaging with a sense of spirituality, part of me is trying to say, who am I? Why am I? Why is there, you know, what is the journey of life? You know, there are questions about meaning and purpose. I think there's also something to do with there's another dimension to how we are, a quality, a sixth sense, that in some sense we come to through beauty, through love, through art, through sometimes a sense of transcendent moments.
Yeah.
But there's something beyond our five senses that we have a sense of.
Like the sublime.
That we can call... Sorry?
And the sublime might be an example of that.
Yes. It's a sort of subliminal, yes, a sublime, but something that's beyond, a quality beyond that which we are, we can kind of define or measure in a way. So I think that's what's spiritual. And I like the idea of that being just a completely imminent, natural part of the human, you know, that we can touch and we can smell and we have this kind of other sense of connection.
Yeah.
And then I think there's a third aspect to spirituality, which kind of in a sense connects meaning and purpose with this sense of these qualities, which is to do with notions like grace or synchronicity, that we have experiences sometimes of these moments in our life when somehow things come together and we have a sense of this matters or this happened, or, you know, wow, I suddenly feel connected to others and to something beyond me. So that's, I think, what for me spirituality is.
For me, I often think it's engaging with your deepest experience, in a sense of integration.
I think I think it could be a sense of integration. I think sometimes integration follows or precedes those kind of moments. And I think there's one of the things I think that's very interesting that connects with complexity for me about spirituality. So, in terms of what does complexity, if complexity were a person, what would it say about spirituality? And one theme, I think, is to do with this kind of paradox or this idea that there are patterns of connection and yet our uniqueness is important, our own unique individuation is somehow the way to connection. So it's this idea that this Jungian idea, partly, that our individuation, our embracing our own and finding our own unique path and our uniqueness, rather than trying to be normal or trying to conform, somehow paradoxically connects us back into something bigger. And Karen Armstrong, for example, in her memoir, talks very much about this. When she gave up trying to be normal or trying to do things that the world might expect her to do, like be a good academic or a good teacher, when she started to really sense who she was and how to embrace who she was, she then had more of this sense of connection with everything, sense of meaning that came out of kind of diving down into the uniqueness. So I think that paradox of oneness, of connection with uniqueness, and it's something that the contemporary philosopher Tim Freake talks about increasingly as well. Karen Armstrong talks about it, Jung and Assaglioli, the transpersonal philosophers of psychology, has this kind of paradox between the two, that if we just think of spirituality as somehow sinking into oneness and regarding ourselves as an illusion, as some people do, we miss it. We have to be both. We have to truly find our uniqueness, and through that we find this kind of transpersonal connection. And sometimes it's the other way around. Sometimes you think, wow, I've just had this moment of real connection, and I feel inspired through that to find out more about myself, so I think it's a kind of paradox that's very implicit. That middle way is central to complexity theory.
Okay, so just bringing this all together, Jean, so how could you summarise what complexity theory has to do with spirituality?
So I think it, which I haven't quite said, it embraces this idea of karma, in a sense. I suppose it was what I was just talking about, this idea that we are shaped by the path we take and the choices we make. But that it's a collective karma, so it's not just saying it's me. It's saying that society and the people I know, it's the choices we all make that shape the future, both for society and for ourselves. And it embraces this tension between connection, oneness and uniqueness. But the oneness that I think complexity would see is not, in a sense, how some people talk, like a vast ocean of something. It's more like a sea with waves, ripples and whirlpools. So it's a structured kind of, it's got form, this oneness. So there's this tension between oneness and uniqueness. And then I talked about, what it means maybe you should do. But what I'd just like to say as well, because it really interests me, it's kind of the edge of where I'm at with all this, is it has nothing to say, really, complexity, about the idea of, like, initial or final cause. It's not saying we've come from somewhere or we're going anywhere. Now, it would still work, if you want to put it that way, and Teilhard de Chardin thought about it this way. He rather saw evolution as within a kind of envelope of love or goodness or moving towards becoming more godlike. Yeah. And you could see it that way. And people do see it that way. But I don't think I do. I think what's really interesting is to say that consciousness or spirituality, in a sense, is like touch, in that touch is neither good nor bad. I can stroke you or I can slap you. This sixth sense, that it may have angels or it may have devils in it. It's not necessarily positive or loving. It just is. It just is a spiritual dimension. And that maybe, and I think this is really interesting, going back to Lee Smolin, maybe in our evolutionary process, we discover love rather than we move towards love. So in some sense, we discover if we're compassionate and empathetic, you know, it's better for us, you know, it's better for society, it sustains better than if we kill each other and hate each other or we're too greedy. Mm-hmm. So, but it could be, if you want to put it that way, that the universe got set itself off with this imminent quality of consciousness or quality of spirituality, but that in a sense, it's not that we're pulled towards good, it's just that we discover, you know, well, if we're bad, we're bad, and bad things happen if we're just simplistic, but, you know, we discover that compassion and connection and love works. It works better. So I think that's really interesting. It's not a teleology, or it's not an initial cause that God set off the universe and said, be good, or, you know, you get pulled towards the great chain of being, but we discover it works, or we discover what works. So I think that's really, for me, that's really interesting. So I think I feel like this quality, this ethereal, transcendent quality is not necessarily, I think it's neutral. It's another sense that's neutral. And I can't prove that. It's just, I think it's really interesting.
Okay, so we've looked at what your understanding of spirituality is. So what do you think of science in relation to this? What does science mean to you?
Well, I think that the real dilemma, the real sadness about modernism is how we've grasped the wrong science for social systems, really, and for natural systems. So science is seen to be scientific, is always about what is measurable, what is predictable, you know, what is objective, and it's become overplayed in relation to the natural and the social world to our detriment. It doesn't work like a machine. And the view, if you ask most people what science is, they see it as really about, you know, well, you have to be objective, you have to measure, you have to predict, and so on. If you go back to what science was, well, I'll interrupt myself there. There are two processes that people talk about with science. You have a theory and then you see if there's evidence for it working, which is the deductive method, or you really immerse yourself in what's going on and see whether there are patterns in it that you can understand, which is the inductive method. And so I think that's okay, but I think that that what goes wrong is when we take a theory that was developed and had evidence in one scenario, in one setting, like the planets or billiard balls, and then infer it applies to social systems, and then act as if it does. It doesn't make it scientific to abstract a science from one milieu to another milieu. That doesn't make it scientific. No scientist would think that was appropriate. It doesn't work. And what we need to do with social and natural systems, like Darwin did, is really start with, well, what's really going on here? What really works? So I think that to be scientific in the social and natural world is not the same thing, and that complexity theory is much more in tune. It's much more a science. It's the science of open systems. It's the science of change. It's the science of diversity. It's much more in tune with the social and natural world, I think, and that continuing to act as if the world is predictable and controllable when it isn't is really destroying our world in a whole variety of ways.
Do you think could you see a potential paradigm shift at some stage to move from the more mechanistic worldview to the more integrated view, that, you know, rather than taking things apart where we start putting them back together in them?
I think it does exist. I think that the two traditions sit alongside one another at the moment. So I don't know whether I put it exactly as a paradigm shift, but I think so if you know, I'm sure this is contentious, but, you know, the UK education system continually tries to define what to teach, how to teach it, measure whether you've taught it all the time. Meanwhile, that Britain is 23rd out of 24 for numeracy and 24th out of 24 developed countries for literacy, albeit it might be the other way around.
Yeah.
You know, so the evidence seems to suggest that what we're doing, and we just do it more. So what we do in the same paradigm is we think, we'll have to measure more. We'll have to define the syllabus more. We'll have to put more pragmatic teaching, not teaching of the imagination, into schools. We'll teach them more facts. We'll do more of it. You know, meanwhile, it doesn't seem to be working. And Britain is pretty near the bottom of, if you measure childhood happiness, teenage pregnancies, you know, numeracy, literacy, number of children going into science, you know, whatever you measure to do with education, we seem to be going downwards. And indeed, things have got worse than they were, you know, when some of us were at school. So that literacy among 60-year-olds is now higher than it is amongst current school children. You know, so could it be we're doing it wrong? You know, so I don't know, you know, whether it's exactly a paradigm shift, but I think that this view of connection, the other part of this, I think, is that not everything that's important is measurable. And this seems like a big issue. And it's where some of this spirituality thing comes in. The fact that we can't measure this sixth sense doesn't mean we can't measure it yet. You know, maybe in the future we will, maybe we won't. But just the fact that you can't measure my inspiration or my imagination or my sense of aesthetic doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And I think we've just got too concrete, and in a whole variety of ways, it's not doing us any good at all.
In one sense, a reflection on that, is complexity theory more a focus on quality than quantity? If you think of how things are measured in a very quantitative way, I come from an educational background, and it's often getting more difficult to conduct qualitative studies because we live in this box-ticking world very much.
Yes. Well, I think sort of yes and no. And it's one, you know, there are traditions in complexity theory that are very realist, very concrete. And so it's kind of saying the world is still a machine, but it's a more sophisticated, complicated machine than we thought. But the way that I've worked with it, which is more with this idea of this world view, I think it allows the option of saying that a complex system, for some people, you know, complex systems is a completely realist project with measurable things in it and concrete things in it. But the notion of a complex system, Brian Goodwin at Schumacher College moved in this direction very much, was there's no reason why it can't include qualitative elements. Prigogine, towards the end of his life, wrote a paper, for example, called Science, Reason and Passion, and talked about the imagination and intention. So they may not be measurable, but they still are in the complex system. That if we're connected in a complex and subtle way, then everything that connects us is in the system.
Yeah.
The fact you can't measure it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Sure.
So it's embraced ontologically, it's embraced in concept, but some complexity people are still doing a realist project. They're just finding more sophisticated feedback loops and things. So I'm talking in a particular way about what I think complexity offers us as an ontology.
Okay, so what is your understanding of the middle way, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I think that in many ways complexity theory is a middle way, in the sense of it's not saying the world is totally structured and measurable. It's not saying it's totally chaotic. It's saying it's in the middle of there is some structure, but it doesn't last forever. And there's some uniqueness and chaos and variety that you don't know that's going to happen. And we kind of move in the middle of these two qualities. It's a tight, loose view. If you're saying how do you manage an organisation that you regard as complex, well, it's having some structure and some clarity of intention and some plans, but also knowing things won't go to plan and you'll have to alter them. It's about inspiration and entrepreneurism and seizing opportunities, as well as planning and deciding what you do. But you need a bit of both. So it's very much in this kind of middle. And I think it also, and this is me talking about spirituality from a complexity lens, I'm really interested in this idea of Xin, X-I-N, which is, as I understand it, a Chinese word for heart-mind.
Yeah.
I think it also, Karen Armstrong in her memoir, which I've just really enjoyed and been reading, talks about the fact that if you come to decisions or come to life with heart-mind integrated, you don't make a heart decision or a head decision, you don't analyse things from one, but you bring those two qualities together. And I've really practiced this in giving lectures on complexity, that if I really connect with the audience and really bring myself into it and bring, in a sense, you know, my heart and my uniqueness into it, people engage with it much more and I do it much better than if I kind of tell this all as a dry rational story.
Yeah.
So there's that's another sort of middle way. So I think it's very much a middle way and fits with, you know, my understanding of the Buddhist idea of the middle way in the same way as that. So I think, it fits very well. And it's the left brain, right brain thing again. It's neither one nor the other, it's both.
Yeah.
You know, so I've both got to say sensible things that I've thought about. I've got to use facts, you know, I've got to research things. And sometimes I have a moment of inspiration. So Einstein dreamt E equals MC squared. He didn't derive it.
Yeah.
And when I knew none of all this stuff, when I was doing my PhD, I used to go to bed completely stuck, you know, thinking, I don't know what I'm doing, I've no idea what to do next. And I'd wake up from a dream almost. I'd wake up with inspiration in the middle of the night and think, hey, that's it, that's what I need to do. So most of our life is about using our instinct, you know, using our emotional intuition, using our brain. So I think it fits very well with that sort of, as I understand, the middle way.
Okay, great. Okay, my last question, Jean. If people wanted to find out a bit more about your work, how would they go about it?
Well, I have a website called embracingcomplexity.com. And there's lots and lots of stuff on there. Some of it's to do with strategy and policy development and research and impact analysis, and some of it's to do with spirituality, and there's articles and videos, links to stuff that I've done. So that's one path. And a book that I've been writing with Peter Allen, who I've spoken about, and also Cliff Bowman, is coming out through Oxford University Press in the summer. And it's called Embracing Complexity, and it will cover what complexity means, this kind of journey through from Taoism through to the ideas. And then the latter half of the book is to do with, so what do you do then? So what does it mean for management, economics, living your life? So some of it's to do with business and some of it's to do with the more personal. And I'm finding myself getting really engaged at the moment with this issue of science and spirituality, and also spirituality and psychology, the kind of the connection between those. So I'm hoping to do some more writing and possibly even write a book along those lines about sort of the more explicitly what complexity has to say about spirituality and psychology and those kind of links.
Great. Oh, well, I look forward to reading the book when it comes out in the summer, Jean. Anyway, yeah. Thank you very much for talking to me today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, not at all. I've loved it. It's been really interesting to prepare for and to speak to you. Thank you very much.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.